Power in the Air, Suffolk Coast, 1939, and Bruneval, France, 1942. Many technicians had stumbled on radar over the years, but the first ones had found it impossible to get their superiors to believe them. In September 1922, for example, Albert Taylor and Leo Young of the U.S. Navy were trying to send a simple radio signal across the Potomac River, but kept getting some sort of interference. They looked up. A steamship was in the way. Yet when they tried to get funding to investigate this effect, they were scoffed at. How could a bulky steamship have any effect on ghostly, weightless radio waves? Similar effects were reported in Russia, France, and most other places where radio was used a lot, but the response was almost always the same. It didn't help that radio technicians tended to be quiet sorts. But luckily, for the survival of Britain, and indeed of the civilized world, at least one radio expert was overwhelmingly the opposite in personality. His name was Robert Watson Watt, and in 1935, he could be found working in the dreary reaches of the Atmospheric Research Station of the National Physical Laboratory near the equally dreary English town of Slough. The poet John Betjeman loved the south of England, but after getting to know Slough, even he was inspired, famously, to write, "Come, friendly bombs, and fall on Slough, and blow to smithereens those air-conditioned bright canteens." A direct descendant of the James Watt who'd perfected the steam engine, Watson Watt had been a promising university student in Scotland, but things had never quite worked out since then. His marriage had long since tapered off to boredom. "I was a dull, drab partner in the small residuum of the 24 hours that were not monopolized by work and sleep. And pretty much everything else was on the same level. I am 5'6", tubby if you want to be unkind, chubby if you want to be a little kind, a bit of a meteorologist, 30 years a civil servant." That last item was the problem. Given his great family legacy, Watson Watt had never imagined he'd end up middle-aged, middle income, and not even of middling fame, there on the edges of governmental research departments, miles from London. And then, in January 1935, a request fell his way from heaven, or rather, it seemed as good, from the Air Ministry in London. A contact there asked him if there was any truth in the rumor that evil death rays could be sprayed from radio transmitters at an aircraft. The question itself was easily enough answered in the negative, for radio waves are too weak to damage a hulking aircraft. But Watson Watt wasn't about to let the matter drop so easily. He knew that the moment he sent his reply back, the door that was now briefly open to the London ministry would close. He'd be stuck in Slough, perhaps forever. But if he played with the idea and came up with something better, then, who knew, he might be regularly called to London. There would be all expenses paid day trips on the railway, briefings he could modestly deliver, superior people to meet, possibly a promotion. What actually resulted from his response to the casual inquiry, ultra-top-secret missions to Washington, private briefings for Churchill, a knighthood from the Queen, and vast funds from a victorious nation, was beyond any of his imaginings. But for the moment, in this wet January of 1935, he actually had to come up with something interesting to tell the Air Ministry in London, and this presented a problem. Although Watson Watt was very proud, he was also rather honest with himself. He understood that although he was a good enough meteorologist, he was, in his sad estimation, at best, a second-rate physicist and a sixth-rate mathematician. He'd made friends, however, with a colleague in his office, Arnold Wilkins, who hadn't been at Slough long enough to resign himself to second-rateness. Wilkins was keen to calculate what else might happen when a radio wave was sent in the direction of an incoming aircraft. The invisible waves that Faraday and Maxwell and Hertz believed in, those magic carpet-like undulations in the force field, wouldn't carry enough power to melt the plane or injure the pilot. But could they do something else? Wilkins thought about it and realized they provided a way to use an enemy's airplane against itself. From his original training in physics, Wilkins knew something important about metal, and in particular, about what could happen inside the metal of an airplane's body. Watson Watt had some training in this area, but wasn't as deft with calculations, which is why Wilkins led the way. Back in the time of Faraday and William Thomson, only a few theorists had imagined that invisible waves could affect ordinary solid substances and make them move. This was fair enough, for when there are no separate charged particles available, when all the charges are tucked away in balanced groups inside an atom as in the ordinary objects around us, then the electric and magnetic forces have nothing to latch onto. Gravity, by contrast, doesn't have opposing parts that can be balanced into neutrality, and so is always noticeable. By the time Wilkins and Watson Watt were collaborating, though, it was becoming clear how the electric effects might work. In the 1930s, an atom was popularly thought of as a miniature solar system, at the center of which is a big, heavy nucleus like our Sun. On the outside, spinning in distant orbits, the separate electrons are like our planets. Radio waves are just undulations in a stretching electric and magnetic field. So when a radio wave or the like swirls over one particular atom, it tries to tug loose some of those electrons.